Live in simultaneous broadcast from a hidden cornfield in Wisconsin and some time-forgotten holy of holies in the Theban Mountains of Luxor, Egypt. Intrepid Radio with Scotty Roberts and Dr. John Ward.
Needless to say, the beast was stunned. A whip crack went his rumpet tail, and the beast was done. He asked us, "Be you angels?" And we said, "Nay, we are but men." Rock
on. Hey, John, are you just a man?
No.
But I don't have the rest of the answer for you.
I was going to say, you're only half a man at about 4 a.m., aren't you?
I'm not even that. I'd go with an eighth.
About an eighth of a man?
Yeah, maybe a sixteenth. But are we talking in inches or centimeters?
Cubits.
Metric cubits.
Cubits.
Oh, then I'm a meter and a half.
There you go. Oh, and cubits, I'm huge in cubits.
You dream.
How is Sweden treating you?
Oh, it's a wonderful country, isn't it?
It has
its downside. It has its upsides. The downside at the moment, it's raining. I'm not used to this rain malarkey. 12 years of being in Egypt, it's not something it's not an everyday occurrence.
So you're not reassimilating. And folks, by the way, if you didn't know it by the opener and by our voice, John's sultry morning voice over there in Sweden, halfway around the globe, and me here in Wisconsin. This is Scotty Roberts and my cohort,
John Ward.
Got to be quicker on the cue.
Sorry. I go for the poetic pause.
Oh, yes, I'm not American. I do not sensationalize.
Oh. Good segue.
What about the sensationalizing stuff? You kind of surprised me. You know, folks, what goes on here sometimes is there are days when we enter this show where we've got so much to talk about, we don't even know what we're going to talk about first. And we talk about it all week, and so I just talked to John for the first time today, about 10 minutes ago, and I said, "So, what do you want to talk about?" And he said, "I'm going to surprise you." And you all know what that means. When John says he's going to surprise me, I go, "Oh, well, what is it?" And I say, "I can't tell you." So we've got something we want to talk to you about. We kind of agreed on something here. We've got a fabulous guest tonight, by the way. And he comes up after the bottom of the hour break, as most of our guests do. Before he comes on, John and I just want to catch you up on a little bit of how we see the world. As you know, with this show, we like to take things from history to archaeology to hermetics, back to fringe history and archaeology, back to alternative viewpoints of history and metaphysics and all of those types of things. Sometimes we have what I consider to be our stellar guests. They're those guests that we have on that, oh, we call Israel and talk to one, or we call somewhere else around the world and we get some pretty phenomenal guests. And sometimes we bring on some guests that are very interesting in their presentation and things that we don't always follow, but we like to present some of that stuff. We like to get out there and expose ourselves. Boy, if I just stopped that sentence right there, John, people would be thinking we're sitting here in trench coats.
I'm actually thinking about you and exposing yourself now.
Ah.
This is not a kind image at this time in the morning.
Well, there, that ought to perk you up though, huh?
Not really. Did you say prick me up?
Perk you up. Such language. Oh, it's British humor, isn't it? Let me see. Let me think about that for a minute. Oh, ha, 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 ha. British humor. So, John.
Yes, brother.
Do you think that we sensationalize?
No, I don't think we do. Sensationalism. sensationalizing, if there's such a word. Sensation. It dawned on me. You know, I've been, as most people will know, if they've been following me on Facebook this week and following all my other various social platforms and yourself, Scotty,
yes.
We've had quite a varied week on posting various news articles.
Yes, we have.
Because we've kept up with the current news. But keeping up with the current news also means that you're trudging through the rest of the garbage that's out there on mainstream media.
Mm-hmm.
And I refer, of course, to the mainstream news outlets. Now, what's dawning upon me, and it's nothing new, of course, we all know this, but sensationalism and how far it really has taken a hold of our society. Do we no longer see a news item for its worth, I mean its actual worth in its credit of news, unless it is sensationalized? Do we need to see the blood and gore? Do we need to see some poor Joe being dragged through the gutter by the press?
Well, I think some of that, you could almost call it news porn.
To a point. But does it, and there was a word that came with some of these stories this week, and that was, are we being desensitized with regards to this news coverage? I give you one example. I saw one news article yesterday which I did not repost due to my viewpoint now on this, the desensitizing. And that was that a young man had been captured by the ISIS brigade, I believe, and during his interrogation was buried up to his neck in the sand, in a hole, with a Kalashnikov held to his head. And they continued to interrogate him, and in the end they gave up. And they continued to bury him.
Okay. And so,
but they buried him alive. Now, this was filmed, then placed on the internet, put with a news channel, and it's out there for everybody to watch. And now, at what point is that, does that get a message across? What message is that sending across? Because there was nothing within the news article that related to the poor chap, whether he was right or wrong. There was nothing that related to the other gentleman that were causing the affliction, were killing him, murdering him. And you're kind of lost in this sensationalism of news. This is the same with what's going on with Gaza and Israel at the moment. They're all both firing rockets backwards and forwards. We see the plethora of dead bodies, both children and women. We see the destruction of disabled units and so forth. They're very careful with their wording. And we see all this mayhem going on in Gaza. And it's very rarely we see what happens in Israel. But this week, we've seen a whole host of videos and news articles coming out of Israel showing the rockets, the Grad rockets and so forth, coming in from Hamas. And we're seeing the destruction and so forth that that's causing, and the mayhem and the air raid sirens taking.
And by the way, this week is almost nothing compared to what Hamas has done. They've launched, since 2001, over 4,800 rockets into populated Israel indiscriminately.
Yeah, and so sensationalism. Do we need to sensationalize our news? And then it kind of led on from there. And I'm thinking to myself, and you've heard me say this now for a couple of weeks, and that is that the word responsibility. Even we, brother, have a responsibility. Because when we're on the air, like now, we have a responsibility to our listeners to come across in a competent, professional manner. We entertain, but we also come forward with snippets of truth, fact, myth, legend, and so forth. But we also have a responsibility that we actually, during that process of entertainment across the airwaves, we're actually kind of influencing. And so that responsibility to influence somebody in maybe their research, maybe the way in which they pray. I mean, we talk about religion quite a lot.
We do.
where do we draw the line between our responsibility and our own responsibilities to ourselves, where we start to coerce the actual topics that we talk about? And that kind of responsibility goes hand in hand with sensationalism. And it kind of leads to the guristic. And this is where I'm leading to. The guristic.
All right. I was wondering where you're going.
Yeah, the guru. Because through sensationalism, what we're starting to see, and this is something else I'm picking up on, is that we're starting to see items that are being used to not just sensationalize news, but to actually make money, sell items of news that in the end actually not only distorts the truth, not only distorts history, doesn't also distort actual present day truth or fact, be that archaeology, be that news, be that history, what have you. But at the same time, it's selling a book. It's selling a trip. It's selling a DVD. It's selling a course. And so somebody somewhere is making money out of sensationalism.
Are you talking about, like with this, say we're looking at a news story about Israel and Palestine and the conflict in Gaza right now. And right next to that is an ad by some former military leader in the United States selling his book on his take on Hamas or something. Is that what you're talking about? That kind of sensationalism?
No, I'm not. I'm talking about sensationalism where they take it to, where they distort. They actually distort the actual truth. They actually distort the news. And that's
give me an example of what you're talking about.
What do I want to go? Let's go with this. I don't want to be specific, actually, because I didn't want to be specific, because you know me, I don't like pointing fingers in people. But there was a specific item I saw this week which distorted history to such an extent that it was obscene. But at the end of this lovely, wonderful, recanted, sensationalized article on the distortion of history, in his own viewpoint, he was trying to sell a trip and a book at the end of it.
Oh.
And what I felt by that was that, okay, we've got everything else that's going around us at this moment. We've got all this complete mayhem going on in the Middle East. We've got complete mayhem going on in North Korea. We've got complete mayhem going off in the Ukraine. We had the unfortunate shooting this week in the States, and of that poor family, execution style. And so you've got all this news hitting you, and then you've got the economy and everything else and the mundane stuff that's going on. So you put your head above the pulpit, and all of a sudden it's being shot in from all different directions. But alongside this, you've got these other sensationalized news stories or adverts, current affairs that are being kind of advertised in such a way in which they slip in to the sensationalism of our life. And this is where I'm trying, this is where I was at the very beginning of the show.
All right.
We no longer react to items that are no longer sensationalized. It has to take on a whole new meaning. It can't just be the bare facts. It's got to be embellished. Take the statue this week that sold at Christie's auction.
For something like $16 million.
The price means nothing. It's irrelevant. But they built it up, $16 million. What they didn't talk about was that the reason why it was being sold was it was being sold to fund the new extension of the museum. Funny enough, the extension of the museum was also going to cost them $16 million. Kind of a coincidence there that the two figures came in the same price. But then they went down this road of 16 million. It was at 14 million. Then it was at 15 million. Then they got to 16 million. And they're sensationalizing the price and everything else while losing the actual efficacy of the real story behind this. And this was the travesty of selling a statue from a museum. And do they have the right, really, moralistically, do they have the right to sell such a statue when a museum is run by a public sector for the people? Surely it's not down to the museum's curator to make a decision on whether he should sell a statue that's over 4,000 years old into a private collection. Surely it should be the actual decision of the people or the crowd.
Well, if that's a museum that's municipal, that is run by the people or owned by the people, so to speak, the people that maybe they should put it to a vote of the people. I would when you look at it in that sense, when I first saw that story, it was like the hue and cry of selling this statue from this particular collection to probably a private collector was the way the story was all worded. And yet I didn't know till late in the game that this was also the museum could expand its facilities. And so they're selling off a piece of its collection. Is that a wrong thing to do? You're calling this sensationalism. Is that a wrong thing to do?
Well, what they didn't tell you was that it had been sat in the store for 4 years. And prior to that...
Sit in storage, in a warehouse, yeah.
Yeah, and prior to that, no one had seen it. No one's researched it. It's been completely recorded, documented, everything about it, every single facet about it has been recorded. There's nothing we do not know about that particular statue from an archaeological, historical point of view. What purpose does it serve sitting in a storeroom out of public view when it belongs to a museum? It no longer functions as a museum piece. It's just gathering dust. Surely it should then benefit somebody in some particular fashion. We don't need to sensationalize the item and say it's a complete travesty that the item is going to be sold. That is a personal point of view. I agree. It shouldn't be sold. But however, if someone's prepared to pay the money for it, let's go with it. Let's see where this leads. At least then we know where the item is. We know what collection it's gone into, and at the end of the day, we know it's not going to be vandalized or broken in half or smashed to pieces by some radical extremist, as we're witnessing right now happening in the Levant.
Well, in the Levant aren't they going in and they're destroying certain ancient monuments and ancient sites? But they're pulling out artifacts and selling them to private collectors or even to museums in order to fund their effort. So here's the big question. If ISIS came to, the Museum of Cairo or the London Museum and said, we have this wonderful piece from the city of Ur in Iraq. And we want to sell this to you for $19 million. And the museum really wants this. Would it be immoral of that museum to buy that piece from a movement like ISIS if they know it was looted and the site is being destroyed?
Yes, I think it would be.
I do too. I do too. What do you folks think out there? If you're sitting there in the chat room, you can certainly express your opinion here, or you can give us a call. But this is something that
Was that your mechanized colostomy bag then?
No, sorry, that was my stomach rumbling.
Oh, okay.
You know, that happened to me once. I was on Coast to Coast, and I was talking to George Norrie. I was standing in my garage on my phone, and here it is at 2 a.m. when I'm on his show for 3 hours. And he's in the middle of questioning me about something, and a car goes by, like a race car. And George Norrie stopped, and he said, "Scotty," he says, "what do you have there, brother? You have a race car? Are you calling me from a racetrack?" So, my summer studio, we shall call it, is a little more or less open air than my winter studio. And so every now and then you get some ambient sounds. You get, atmosphere. So,
and that's the birds in the background. Good timing there. Well done.
Yeah. Well, so, you have birds and crickets and kingfishers splashing in the water around you. So
true. So sensationalism. It's got my goat this week. I'm sorry to say it has got my goat because it doesn't matter where I look, it's there, and I feel to myself, are we becoming so stupid as a society, that everything needs to be sensationalized for us to actually view it, for us to respond to it? cannot not just be advertised. Even advertising, sensationalism. It's got to be sensationalized.
Well, I think in the West especially, you know, let's say for yours and my book on the Exodus reality, we were accused from certain circles of being sensationalist with our book because we built around it a tour where we take people to go see that, the Exodus reality adventures.
Well, no, because we built the tour afterwards.
We built the tour afterwards. But then the fact that it's full of photos and that we had fun doing what we're doing and, this is just a book with the two authors, you know, are showing us their fun times on the road in Egypt, you know, and I wanted to see more meat in the book. It's sensationalized. It's sensationalized in that, sensationalism, I suppose, can take even a very small look, if you will. Look at the book itself. We have to design a cover for it. We wanted the color spreads to be really pretty and really get
it. Isn't that
sensationalism?
No, but isn't that aesthetics?
That's aesthetics.
I think, where do we draw the line between sensationalism and what we would call eye candy, something that draws your attention? Where does one draw the line there? Do you have to set off fireworks for it to be called sensationalism? I don't think, and I cannot agree for one second, that our book is sensationalism or we have sensationalized anything within it. There isn't anything sensational in that respect. We don't sensationalize either one of our topics in that manner. Because we don't distort anything. That's what I'm trying to get to. There is a distortion within sensationalism that has become so accepted now that we just turn a blind eye to it.
Now, would you consider somebody like, and I can name him because he's very public about this, and I've heard the caterwaul that he is a sensationalist. Take Shimka Yakubovici. He had his show on History International, which later became H2, which now exists, but The Naked Archaeologist. And he had a great show, and he handled archaeology and history with a real comic verve, if you will, a vox populi, you know, getting down to the level of the voice of the people and trying to bring very interesting topics into somebody's drawing room. And he comes out every now and then with a great article about something, and he had an article out about the what's the little shrine stone that was found, the Al Harish, is that what it is, Al Harish stone? It's that that little shrine stone that supposedly has a picture of the parting of the Red Sea and the hieroglyphics on it.
Okay.
And things like that. And he brought this story out and he said, here is proof that this story of the Exodus is true. And, you know, that was the way he promoted the story. Or about the tomb of Jesus, the Talpiot tomb that he talks about. Mm-hmm. And his critics will say he's just sensationalizing those topics.
But it's not.
And I say that's not sensationalizing.
No.
Isn't
no, it's
that
not sensational.
Somebody who has made a discovery and with his years of research says, I think this is something that's a keystone piece of evidence. And he puts it out there, but he gets accused of sensationalizing by taking.
No, I think we've gone past that kind of. You could use that, Scott, quite rightly in the way in which the context in which you're using. I think you could quite easily get away with that if we go back 20 years. But I think now we have to use that word quite carefully when we say sensationalism, sensationalizing, because it carries with it now so much more weight than it did, say, 20 years ago. And I think you're quite right there in saying that, you know, if you came out with some tombstone or came up with some tomb and you kind of built it up as being the last tomb of Jesus Christ, one could accuse you of being sensationalizing the storyline. Today, though, I think it takes on a whole different connotation. What I'm trying to say, and I repeat again, I believe that with sensationalism, it goes hand in hand with distorting, and manipulating the truth. Not downright lying, but distortion and manipulation of the facts to sell a story or sell a bill of goods to persuade you in either way, be that politically, faith motivation, what have you. It's a distortion, and it's being used so openly and at every corner that we have become completely and totally accepted of it. We just accept it. It's the norm. And I think I'm afraid that we may be coming to a point where we will actually overlook certain facets of society because they're not sensationalized. Take politics. Isn't America? Compare American politics to British politics. In America, you have all these debates, and it's all about the red, the blue, and the white, and the flag, and it's very, very, very patriotic, but it's very in your face. It's very much there, isn't it?
Sure, it is.
When you have a presidential election type thing, it's all big and brash, as they say, the typical American way.
Damn,
you've got a good show, you know.
And I do understand that because I see that in American politics all the time. But then you also see, now, is this a form of sensationalizing that you're speaking of? I watch the news.
No, what I'm trying to get to is that now British politics is going down exactly the same route as the American system.
Oh, wow.
Because distortion, manipulation, the general public in certain sectors respond to that stimuli. And that's what I'm afraid of, that there are certain pockets of our society that no longer respond to just the norm. They only respond to sensationalism.
Well, something I have noticed, though, and is this, do you think, a result of sensationalism? Sensationalism is when you hear a story like Israel launches attacks on Hamas sites and kills 182 civilians in the Gaza Strip. Now, that's only a partial truth. But when you hear that story, people will listen to that for all of a minute or two, and then they go, oh, the game's on, and they've got to switch over to the game. I think we're desensitized a bit over here to what happens in other parts of the world. We also see that as, oh, my neighborhood's good, so I got to watch the game. And we get uninvolved in what's going on around the world. We express our political opinions in social networks and on chat rooms and things like that. But there's not really anything we can do anything about, and we don't pay much attention to it after that because, oh, my hot dogs are burning on the grill. I'll get back to this conversation later tonight. And now I only bring up those kinds of examples to say I have been in conversations where in social network where I express my opinion about these things, and I list some of these news stories, as do you, and people are so detached from what it really is all about over there, with very few exceptions, that it becomes something to argue about politically, and that's as far as it goes. And everybody's got their argument, but nobody really knows what's going on. They either filter it through their psychobabbly view of how the world should be geopolitically, or they have no idea at all. You know, I get some of these kids that'll come on, and they'll want to say, can't we all just get along?
Oh, please, and, don't start. Don't start with the liberal namby-pamby stuff with me.
And I said, well, why don't you go over and fly over and find the leaders of Hamas and sit them down and present that to them and see how they react. And after they've slapped you to the floor for not covering your face and your head and your arms because you're a woman, I said, please report back into us. And, you know, this is America's view of what's going on in the world right now, which is sad.
It is sad. But, you know, it's while you were saying all that, I was drawn to the storyline of the execution of that poor family by the gentleman that was looking for his sister, for his wife, and he went to the sister's house and shot the entire family with their hands tied behind their backs, shot them in the back of the head. One of the daughters survived, so I believe her head was grazed and
the bullet didn't
actually make full impact.
15-year-old
and she played dead. Now, to me, I can't even begin to understand how someone does that within society. I just don't get that. I want to use the word abhorrent to me, because I think that it goes beyond tragedy. It goes beyond anything of the norm. And yet it's treated within the news along the same lines as sensationalism. So therefore we are then desensitized to the story.
Right.
And we lose that empathy that we would have with the family.
I agree.
That news item, 10 years ago, not even, yes, let's go say 10 years ago, Scotty, if that story broke 10 years ago, it'd still be in the papers today. It would be in the papers for a whole month. There'd be a string of news articles and backlash surrounding that particular story.
But of course, that story now—it's current, but it's forgotten gone. When it's the forgotten. World Cup news comes on,
because we're desensitized to it.
Yeah, we are.
Even you, Scotty, and John are talking about a man who murdered in cold blood, executed an entire family, and we just desensitized it.
Right. Well, John, I hate to say this, I'm becoming desensitized to your monologue, because we're pushing our break.
Let's go for it.
We have got to go out to break. And folks, we have a fantastic guest, Timothy Freak, coming on. We'll tell you all about him in just a couple of minutes. So this is Scotty Roberts and Dr. John Ward. We're going out to break. Stay tuned. We're going to be right back with a fantastic interview with Tim Freak. Hang on.
It's a lot like riding a two-humped camel. Intrepid Radio with Scotty Roberts and Dr. John Ward. Intelligent talk.
Imagine a place, beautiful, green, sloping mountains, and a rich, mysterious window into our ancient past. It's a culture the likes of which you won't find anyplace else. And while the place I'm describing is in Vermont, it's also the home of Inner Traditions, publishers of fine books on mind, body, and spirit for more than three decades. Inner Traditions are internationally recognized publishers of everything from occult to esoteric and spiritual books, as well as the leading authorities on alternative health, holistic healing, sacred sexuality, altered states of consciousness, and so much more. And frankly, it's not the kind of information you'll find just anywhere. Exploring the inner secrets of humanity requires thinking outside the box. And when it comes to Inner Traditions, the name says it all. All you have to do to learn more is visit innertraditions.com, and you can receive a free catalog that will tell you all about their latest books and newest authors. That's Inner Traditions and Bear & Company, publishers of fine esoteric books for more than three decades. Find them online at innertraditions.com.
Carl Sagan once wrote that the questioning mind needs to be instilled with both skepticism and wonder, for the universe is a pretty big place, filled with undelved mysteries, sciences, and life that we've barely begun to comprehend. Every month, Intrepid Magazine brings you both the wondrous and the skeptical. Intrepid Magazine focuses on science, metaphysics, UFOs, politics, conspiracies, and unexplained phenomena, all offered up by Intrepid's cadre of writers and contributors, comprised of a host of seasoned authors, pundits, and recognized names in their fields. The universe is indeed a big place, and where other magazines leave off, Intrepid Mag is just beginning. Subscribe to Intrepid Magazine today at www.intrepidmag.com. That's www.intrepidmag.com.
Ready for some rollicking adventure? In Scotty Roberts' book, The Rollicking Adventures of Tam O'Hare, join Irish Rabbit, Tam O'Hare, and his young squirrel squire, Horatio McNutt, as they journey through Scotland of the mid-1500s seeking a small child who's been stolen by the fairy folk. Crafty raccoon pirates, conniving noble wolves, Conflicted royal foxes and self-serving religious badgers all stand in the way as their quest brings them headlong into high seas action and supernatural intrigue. The Rollicking Adventures of Tam O'Hare is in bookstores everywhere and at BarnesandNoble.com. This hardcover, lushly illustrated chapter book is the first book in the Tam O'Hare series, so swash your buckle and prepare yourself for a historically rollicking, swaggeringly supernatural adventure. Visit TamO'Hare.com to learn more. You'll never trust a raccoon with a sword again.
You can take the boys out of the city, but you can never plug a dam in Denmark with your thumb. Intrepid Radio, with a haphazardly focused Scotty Roberts and the rollicking adventurous Dr. John Ward, sticking their fingers in the hole in the dike of humanity.
All right, folks, we're back. This is Scotty Roberts, and I have, of course, my cohort, John Ward, who is not on the deck of his dahabeah floating on the Nile River near Luxor, Egypt. John, you're in Sweden, right?
I am indeed. Wonderful, beautiful, rainy, windy, thundery, lightning Sweden.
I suppose it's got to be a change to be walking to the marketplace and seeing all blonde heads and blue eyes as opposed to all your Egyptian neighbors.
Just a tad. Just a tad. It does turn one's head.
I suppose. Well, we have got...
One has to avert one's eyes.
I'm averting my eyes, O Lord. That's my Monty Python for the day. So we have got a wonderful guest with us, and his name is Timothy Freak, as we've mentioned in the first half hour. And Timothy is somebody whose work I have followed for a long time. I first picked up his book... The Jesus Mysteries, some years ago, and was very intrigued by that as I was dealing with some of the questions of my own in those arenas. And John, as you know, me being the biblicist of the two of us, you being the biblical minimalist,
don't
really
know it.
you'll probably enjoy some of the things we talk about tonight. And let me give you just a brief. We've got Timothy just standing there or sitting there waiting for us. But let me give you a very brief. It's just from his website. You can go to themysteryexperience.com and see a lot about Timothy right there. But he's a stand-up philosopher, which was something that really intrigued me. That title. He calls himself a stand-up philosopher. We'll have him explain what that is. I have kind of, and Timothy, I hope you don't mind, I kind of stole that from you, and I've called myself a stand-up philosopher at times based on some of the things I do, but I think you are the real defining point for that. That's a concept
that... I was going to say, that's never really worked for you, though, has it, really?
Quiet over there in Sweden. It's from the ancient idea of the philosophers as the traveling spiritual entertainers. It's like sitting at the feet. Could you imagine sitting at the feet of Socrates or sitting at the feet of Aristotle and listening to them? I have to only imagine in my head that these guys weren't dry. Like they wouldn't say, turn in your papyrus to scroll number 4 and we're going to talk about, I think these guys were energetic. They had something. But he's pioneering this accessible new way to experience what he calls a profound spiritual awakening. Now, John and I, Timothy, and by the way, welcome, Timothy.
Thank you. Thank you for that marvelous introduction.
Well, thank you.
He tries his best, Timothy.
Yeah, I try.
You can expect papers from my solicitor about taking the stand-up course.
only if he's wearing a white powdered wig, then I'll be happy. I just heard recently, because of the 4th of July here, I saw some British comic doing a routine, and he said, there's so many things, he says, from Great Britain that you would have, that you don't have now because you separated from us 240 years ago. He says, and one of them is he says, you could go to court and have a judge with a white powdered wig. And he says, think of the change that would bring to your system of jurisprudence. Well, anyway, Tim,
the health service, of course.
And the health service, yes. Ours is pretty botched up at the moment. Well, we won't go into that.
China teacups and a couple of biscuits.
John gets me started on politics without even knowing it. And he'll say, oh, Scotty, you said, don't go there. And I'm like, you started it. So, Timothy, I was, as I just mentioned, I was first drawn to your work by reading the Jesus Mysteries, and I want to talk about some of that stuff, but not right away. The first thing I'd like to get into is John and I are, some of the things we do, the things we talk about, the books we write, we're in that more academic realm, but we try to bridge that gap between academia and fringe theory, fringe history, fringe philosophy, things like that. And John and I, by far, are not your dry, stodgy scholars and sitting in a, you know, some kind of office somewhere. We like to get out there and get our hands on, and there's definitely the emotional side and the spiritual side that we have. Sometimes you have to downplay that. Sometimes you play that up very big. So I'm very interested in what you do beyond some of the works. And I might say here that the books of yours I've read aren't stodgy, scholarly books. They are books that have intent that's different than just getting across historical information or scholarly information. And that leads me to ask you about the mystery experience. This is something that you have, you're pioneering this. You say here that it's a new way to experience a profound spiritual awakening that fully embraces our tender, vulnerable, flawed humanity, and that you've spent your life exploring the awakened state that you call the mystery experience. So tell us about that. What is that?
Well, I think, you know, I'm a great believer. If you're going to do historical books like the Jesus Mysteries, controversial books, then you do need to be scholarly. And whilst my friend and co-author Peter Gandy and I, when we wrote that, and we'll discuss why that's controversial, I'm sure, later, but when we wrote that, I felt like everything we said, we needed to be able to footnote, we needed to be able to justify. And whilst we wanted to make it an accessible, enjoyable read, we needed that. But also, I guess I never ended up in mainstream academia because it felt as if it was playing some sort of game whereby you, as if you were actually detached from life itself and could just observe it from some dispassionate place. And I don't feel that. I feel like I'm right in the middle of the mystery of life. That's where I find myself. I'm a curious human being, alive and having this amazing experience, and I don't know what it is. And the only reason I'm bothering to write, which, as you know, I'm sure from your experience, takes an immense amount of time and effort, is to communicate with other interested, curious human beings who are also going, yeah, what is this experience of life that we're having? How can we understand the past? How can we look to the future? And most importantly, well, what is it that's happening right now? So my interest is far from detached. I feel like when I write a book, there's an agenda, and unashamedly so. And my central preoccupation is not with the history of spirituality, although I've written a lot of books on just about all of the different spiritual traditions of the world, looking into what they're saying and why. My main interest is my own strange journey through life. And that started for me, in my spiritual journey, if you like, although it's a word I'm not very keen on, to be
sure,
honest.
Sure.
But that journey, which gets called spiritual, started for me when I was very young, when I was 12 years old, with a spontaneous awakening, what would be called an awakening, and a change of state. And from that moment on, my major interest in life has been, what the hell is this other state that human beings can enter and which I can enter? How can I explore it? How can I share it with others? And who are these people that in the past have already been exploring that, and what can they teach me? And all of the books on Christianity, and indeed Hinduism and Buddhism and Sufism and shamanism, and all of my personal explorations through those in a very practical way as well, has been about this other state, which people call being awake, because it just feels like you're more awake.
You know, something that I've said about the things that John and I are engaged in here, with Intrepid Magazine, with Paradigm Symposiums, with the books that we write, the things that we do. We do these things because they're the things that we like to do. It's the things that drive us passionately.
Yes.
Now, I'm gleaning from what you're saying is that is what you are doing. You're saying you are exploring who you are, why you're here, what you're doing. But you mentioned this spiritual awakening when you were a young lad. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, it happened. I mean, my experience of being a young boy was, it felt to me as if all of the adults were in some sort of coma. Because
much like John.
Because yeah. It seemed to me that this incredible thing was happening. I was alive. I had no idea why. I had no idea what it was. And it felt like none of the adults did either. It's just they were pretending they did. And with that innocent view of a child, it just seemed preposterous that no one was sitting there. That why everyone, in fact, wasn't, I still have this, wasn't constantly going, what's going on? You know, what is this? What's this experience we're having? What is this? What is reality? What is identity? What is... You know? And one day, just sitting on this little tiny hill in this very ordinary town where I was born, in the West Country of England, I went so far, I think, now I would probably what happened, was I just became so immersed in the mystery of life that this spontaneous shift, I would say now being deep awake, happened. And the hallmarks of that, as has been found by countless people through the many generations, is a profound sense of oneness and an enormous experience of love, of connectedness, but a visceral, sensual connectedness that reaches right from the body up to the deepest part of ourself. And it was a huge feeling of relief, of coming home, of familiarity, and yet also a big surprise, very paradoxical. And
Jim,
it made a big impression on me.
If you don't mind me asking you that.
Not at all.
I can sympathize with everything you've just said, and what do you think it is that stops others from having that experience? And what I mean by that, let me just try and clarify that, in the way in which they probably are having that experience, but there's something inherent either around them in their own environment or their upbringing or consciously happening or subconsciously happening that prevents them from experiencing that experience. It's as if it's filed away, and so one cannot experience it anymore or even understand what it is. It's just not acknowledged.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And I think there's a lot could be said in the answer, but I think the one of the big things is that we become so immersed in a story about who we are and what life is, and often unconsciously. So we're immersed often just in the story which happens to be the hegemony of our time. It happens to be the story that everyone else is telling. Usually that is the case. So we don't even know that it's a story. We just think it's common sense. The fact that our ancestors believe something completely different, we don't even know that often. That we're in a story, and that prevents us seeing the most obvious thing, which is why, you know, when, as a stand-up philosopher, one of the things which I see myself doing, which is so silly.
The same as Scotty.
Plagiarized version of Scotty.
is to simply go around to people. I feel like, you know, I come up behind people whispering, have you noticed life's a mystery? Because often people haven't noticed that. And it's the most obvious thing. The most obvious thing is none of us know what this is.
Well, isn't this the most obvious thing?
And when you see that, consciousness changes. So in answer to your question, John, I feel like what often happens is we don't see it because we're so caught up in the concepts, our ideas about, I mean, ideas are great, don't get me wrong, but we're so lost in them, we don't see through them to the reality of the mystery. And then but when it does happen, when we do see through, and like you said, people are having this experience all the time, it becomes very easy afterwards to not lose it. So that I see people a lot have very profound awakenings, and then within a very short period it's easy to lose it because you need to keep revisiting it, like anything. And it can soon, my experience, I don't know what yours is, but if I, even though this is a kind of an exaggeration, but when I'm at my most immersed in kind of common sense reality, this state of being awake and oneness and love can all sound like airy fairy mumbo jumbo. When I'm most deep awake, the normal everyday sense seems unreal. And wherever you stand, the other can seem unreal. And learning to be able to stand in both, so you see the reality of both, takes quite a bit of journeying to achieve.
Well, that's like something that...
Indeed.
Now, that's something I've noticed too. It's I've always put it into the context of like this. If you boil it down to, you know, the basics around me, I live in American culture, obviously, but people go from their day to day, from they get up in the morning, have their pot of coffee, and they have their cup of coffee, they go to work, they come home, they mow the grass, they watch television, they do their sports on the weekends, go camping in the summer, but they go through these routines of life. And many people that I know don't even pause to think about anything beyond that. This is their existence. This is what they do. And John and I talk about this stuff an awful lot when we're together, when we're traveling, when we're doing our stuff, is there's something more than what we're experiencing on the surface. And there's something more even than our religious backgrounds. I was in, as all our listeners know, and I've said before, I was very Baptist and very traditional, fundamental Christian evangelical circles in the earlier part of my life. And we did that by rote. And there was no real awake there, if you will, to use your words. Yeah. There was the do it because this is what we do.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think, although, you know, it's tricky, because part of me wants to go, yes, I know exactly what you mean, and I do. And then I also see that people are having all sorts of experiences all the time. It's just they don't talk about them. And one of the reasons for that is because no one else is. And so what happens is that people are having numinous experiences. I mean, life comes and gets you, I think. You know, death comes and gets you. Suffering comes and gets you. Things happen which sooner or later you force you out of that numbness that we think of as normal, and force us to respond in some way. I worked with people who were dying for a while in my life, and I've been around death a lot, and I see that, you know, when something will touch you sooner or later, and you see the mystery. The question is, do you become terrified and therefore withdraw, or do you open out to it, and that's when these other states can happen?
Do you think most people see those things and have no concept of how they should react, and therefore that's why they retreat? The mystery is, I don't know anything about what's going on here. My father died. I have no idea why that happened or where he's going or what's going on. And they retreat into grief, but that's all the further they can take it. They may get those deeper thoughts about what's going on around us. There's more to this world than what we experience, but many people just will not tap into that.
Yes, and I think part of what I'm attempting to do in my own little life, through my books and my teaching, is to offer a way which I'm trying to create as best I can, which draws on the wisdom of the world as human wisdom, not as any particular tradition, and also finds a new vocabulary to go, look, it's okay to be an explorer. You don't have to go to a great guru. You don't have to play a game. You don't have to go to some dogma. You can just be honest with what we find. And if we do that, the numinous, if you like, of life, the depths of life do reveal themselves. And what I see at I do these gatherings, I call them retreats for want of a better word, where we get together for a weekend. I, you know, do them all over the world. And what I see is I get such a interesting bunch of different types of people, and nearly everyone can directly experience this awakening. And when they do, you know it for yourself.
Now, there's a term you used when I was looking at some of your information on the Mystery Experience site, where you talk about, correct my terminology, I'm trying to remember the phrase you used, it's this being, this awakening that's with you, it's like that conscious awake while you're there. It's not going into trance, it's not meditating, it's something that's with you all the time. What did you call that? I'm trying to find it on your website as I'm talking about it.
Say that again. Describe that again, Scotty.
You encapsulated it, in two words. It's this being awake, this being there kind of thing. This isn't something that you take into this transcendental realm. It's something that's with you. It's here. It's active.
Absolutely. I mean, for me, the philosophy that I've been trying to develop is one which I call paralogical. Because what I'm looking at doing is developing a way of thinking about reality based on an understanding that life is, by its very nature, paradoxical. And what that leads me to is a new way of approaching spirituality, which isn't about rejecting our humanity to achieve our divinity, to use old language. It's about going, look, we're both of those. What I am here meeting you, to put it on a very, you know, one image, I am the universe and I am Tim. As Tim meeting the universe as Scotty and the universe as John, what else could we be? If we just meet on the surface, we're just these separate individuals, and that's powerful and interesting. But if we seek backwards, if we sink backwards into our deeper identity, there's a profound sense of oneness which arises, and we can meet in both of those. So it's not either this or that, it's both this and that.
Okay.
Tim, do you mind if I come in here?
Did that make sense? I'm aware that made
a lot of sense.
Perfect sense.
I want to probe it a little differently, but let me let John try to get a word in.
I just wanted to voice, do you think there's a danger out there? And thankfully, I've been through your website and listened to what you've said. Even just in the past 20 minutes, I've already made my conclusions with regards to this. And so I'm not casting any dispersions here. But do you think there's a danger out there with these kind of guristic spiritual gurus who try to tap into this awakening? And I know we're all three of us are now speaking on from the same page. We all understand what we're talking about here. But do you think there is a problem out there, and it has been taken advantage of, especially now during this particular time that we're going through at the moment, where there is more of a conscious awakening, if I can use those kind of new agey words. But do you think there is a problem out there with these gurus?
Yes, massive. I hate it. I don't feel, you know, I feel, wherever I go, I'm going to end up a maverick just because it's my nature. So I don't like being in spiritual circles. I don't feel at home amongst, often when, if I'm ended up presenting, I feel much more, you know, with a conference or something, I feel much more resonance with the audience than I do the other speakers. Not because I don't like them as individuals, they're often lovely. It's just because I see games being played. And I'm not just interested. I started this when I was 12. I'm now 55. I've seen a lot. And it's just boring. And what I'm interested in is something which is much more authentic than that. And I want to meet other people who are also looking authentically. Now, the problem that you have, I think, is that wherever you look in life, you get this ambivalence. That's part of the paradox. So in spirituality, at its best, you get something which is very raw, very real, and very deep. At its worst, you get something which is preposterous. Which is full of itself and really is just, just going to have the opposite effect to which it's designed. But you also get that in science, you know, at its very best. You get something which is, you know, thorough and deep and authentic, and at its worst, you get something which is hubristic, narrow, and reductionist. I guess it's with everything.
Good answer.
Good answer. And I think that that's probably a good time, a good place to go out to our break for this first half hour with Timothy Freak. Folks, you are listening to Timothy Freak from TheMysteryExperience.com. Go check out his website, and you can see some of his books. We're going to come back after about, 4 minutes or so after this break, right here on the Intrepid Radio program on KGRA Digital Radio.
Club tells the story of a spaceman deserted on a faraway world, comforted in his final days only by a music device containing his favorite music to remind him of home.
Take the children and yourself and hide out in the cellar. By now the fire will be close at hand.
Walk on the ocean, step on the stone. Flesh becomes water, blood becomes bone.
Thousands of years later, his remains are discovered by an alien race, and from his belongings discover something called music.
Can you hear?
Sky Club, a self-titled CD with Mac Maloney, contains these songs that gifted an entire civilization with music.
Somebody tell my mama if I die. Somebody
CD comes with a lavishly illustrated booklet chronicling the life, death, and rebirth of the space traveler. A must-have for any music lover. Sky Club with Mac Maloney. Available now at Amazon and on iTunes.
Rain on my face. Now you can share the topics that drive the discussions of your favorite talk shows with TalkStream Live's topic-driven talk radio. List and promote real-time talk radio topics or post the topics that you want to hear. Hot topics are tweeted and retweeted and include simple click-to-listen audio links. The future of talk radio is topic-driven talk radio. Available now at TalkStreamLive.com.
When you're listening to nothing but the best of paranormal talk radio on the internet, you're listening to KGRARadio.com. Digital Broadcasting.
Simultaneous broadcast from a hidden cornfield in Wisconsin and some time-forgotten holy of holies in the Theban Mountains of Luxor, Egypt. Intrepid Radio with Scotty Roberts and Dr. John Ward. Intelligent talk.
Okay, folks, we are back from that little disturbance called a commercial break. And I've got my cohort, Dr. John Ward, here. You are in Sweden now, broadcasting from Sweden.
I'm still here.
You're still there. And before we get back to our guest, I just want to mention to everybody, remember the Paradigm Symposium is coming up this October, the 2nd through the 5th, in Minneapolis, Minnesota, not far from where my little shack is here in the cornfields of Wisconsin. And we've got some amazing speakers this year, and you'll want to take a look at our website, paradigmsymposium.com, and go see the speaker list. We have Graham Hancock, Eric Von Daniken, Andrew Collins, Laird Scranton, Richard Dolan, and the list goes on and on and on. So avail yourself of the information at the website, and get your tickets now. Now that's it for our little live plug. I want to get right back to our fascinating guest here. And I got to tell you, Tim, there is, without sounding maudlin or woo-ish, for lack of any better terms, there is a draw that I have had to you, even though we don't know each other. There's something about your personality that has come out in your writing, some of the videos I've watched with you in them, that draws me to you. And there's something about what you are engaged in that is so deeply appealing. And there's got to be a reason for that that's beyond, hey, I just like the way this guy looks or talks. Talk about, address that. There's something. I'm not asking you to make it about you here necessarily, but what is that that draws us into the message that you're trying to get across?
My hope, Scotty, is that there is that we're in a form of evolution. Consciousness is evolving, and that something new wants to come into the world. It will evolve from the past, but it will be something new, and that there are various people in there own journeys who are beginning to resonate with that and contributing to that. And my attempt as a philosopher has been to try and say things in a way which can help other. My favorite thing, which I get a lot, and I'm very lucky, is when people come up to me after a talk and they go, "Wow, thank you, Tim. You said what I've been thinking but couldn't quite say."
Yeah.
And that's, I feel like, then when I hear that, I go, oh, I'm doing the job. That's what I spend a long, long time trying to find a way of saying what seems intuitively true to me in a way which can make sense and is convincing and which is rational, and yet actually deals with life as I experience it, in the hope that others will also go, yeah, that's working for me. And then on top of that, my aim is to try and model by my own life how to implement that, which means, in my case, being very real about the fact that I'm just Tim, and that if you got to know me, there'd also be things about me that you wouldn't like so much. And, you know, if you were with me a lot, you'd find me irritating, like everybody. and not to hide that and to be real about that, and yet also to go, and as well, I do experience these other states, and I can share them with you, in which we are huge. And what we can see in each other is extraordinary. And there can be a profound love without it being a fluffy, kind of silly word. It can be a strong, deep, serious word.
I think you've hit on something there, too, and John and I experience this. We are, John is probably the dearest friend I have in this world. And I love this man deeply. And yet there are times I'm sure we get under each other. He said, as he would say, he gets under my cravat. And, not anything really seriously, but you are exposed to people for any length of time and you get to know who they are and what they're about and that, hey, wait, that guy is just as flawed as I am, which is kind of something you mentioned. We all are wholly aware of our flaws and the things that we bring to the table. But that does not mean that there is a power of a message here that transcends who we are.
Exactly.
You've hit a chord there. How would you, and John, if you've got something there, let me throw this in before you. I let you start up again, because I like to monopolize your time. How would you respond to people, and maybe you've hit on some of this already indirectly, but people that look at a message like what you're giving and presenting and are so locked into the modes of how they do things already. Well, I can't listen to that. That's as John mentioned, that guru stuff. I can't get into that because that flies in the face of my religious training or flies in the face of things that I already think I know or I'm too manly. I can't click into love and peace and awake and all that. How do you respond to those, to that kind of thinking?
Well, it really depends how long I've got with the person, because if it's just a reaction, then I respect it and accept it, because that's, it's not my journey, that's their journey. But if we have longer to engage, and certainly if somebody has actually come to one of my events, then normally that can be turned inside out. And it's not something I do, it's something which I allow to happen. And if you give enough space to and create the right environment for people, then I think it happens quite naturally. So I've seen, there's usually someone who comes on one of my retreats who's been brought by their wife or their friend.
Yeah.
Who's really not very sure why they've come. And yet often will have the most profound experience. So I just have immense confidence now, a huge confidence in the depth of each individual, that given the chance, it will come out and that they will suddenly find themselves relaxing into who they are. And when they do, they'll be very, 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 very pleased with what they find. Because once you can accept that we all have a flawed humanity, it's part of what we are, you can also start to discover that we have this incredibly beautiful depth and that there is a massive love in each one of us. And finding that is a huge relief. And seeing it in each other is just a great delight. Transforms the life experience completely.
Beautiful.
I like that. There's several things that come to my mind as I'm thinking about that and maybe this is more dovetailing off the same thing I just asked, but you're going to face those people that don't want to have anything to do with this. Maybe I'm personalizing that too much. It's not you personally interacting with them. There are going to be people who react to your message that way. But like you said, once they are there and once they have the opportunity to let down that wall, they can accept some of that and they start seeing that. And this all goes to that. I'm seeing that there's this greater awareness that can be had of what we are made of and the goodness, if you will, quote unquote, that is there. But does that then not fly in the face of well, a lot of religious teaching will teach you that we are all actually really bad at the core, and it's only the sufficiency of doing this or this in a religious sense that makes you any good, and the good that's in you is also evil, is kind of the church teaching. How do we get around that notion, get people beyond What have become maybe catchphrases and call words that, that people start to shun because they immediately associate that with some kind of weird guruism or weird new agey type of thinking. How do we get around that?
Well, I guess that takes us back to the start of the conversation when you mentioned the Jesus Mysteries. Because
right.
The reason for me that I've engaged in writing more critical books, as well as, you know, I haven't, you know, in my many, many books, I haven't written just books about the awakening process. I've also looked at religious traditions and tried to point out where I think we've misunderstood them, or whether they're actually, where they're downright not helping us. And my sense is we need to also encourage doubt, because doubt sets us free. Doubt is what makes us conscious. Until you doubt something, it is just indoctrination. It's unconscious. The minute you doubt something, you have the chance to either free yourself from it or to consciously accept it. And then it's yours. Up until then, you think it's yours. It's not. It's just your upbringing. And so one of the jobs, I think, of people who are trying to bring in a new way of being is to be skeptical, is to have doubt, is to be open-minded, is to question themselves and each other, so that once you do that, once you enter into a place where you can have genuine inquiry, then there's a chance to constantly find out you're wrong, and every time you find out you're wrong, you learn something. And that's the most delightful experience you can have.
Ain't that the truth? As John sometimes, very frequently with me, finds out he's wrong about his theories about Moses.
You dream, sir. Tim, I've been meaning to ask this for a while now, and Scotty keeps on interrupting with his lame questions. But
sorry, but I had another question here, John.
But you do actually have some good, worthwhile answers. But, you know, we're moving on. But no, all seriousness. The last couple of questions Scotty's actually asked kind of indirectly associate themselves to this question I have. The problem I have with this question is that I don't know how to articulate it to you. So I'm just going to speak my mind and see if hopefully you understand it, and hopefully Scotty understands it as well.
Hope you're wearing your iron shorts here, Tim.
Where do you think, or how do you think, and as I say, this is why I'm having problems in articulating this, because I'm trying to figure out the best way to say it, responsibilities. People like yourself, and very much similar to Scotty and myself as well, who are in, say, a public arena, who have responsibilities to their audience, to their followers, because people do listen to us, people do respond, and they do act upon things or comments that we may pursue. How do you, I hate to use these words because I know you don't like them, and I don't like them either, and that is a spiritual teacher, a mentor, a philosopher, how do you temper those responsibilities in yourself, knowing that people are coming to you who are having this awakening? And I know all of us have seen these people, and we are those people. And as people who are already awakened, if that's the correct terminology, we can see the similarities in the journey that people take when they have this epiphany, this wake-up call. And we all go down that same pathway, seeking certain answers to certain questions which are relevant within our mainstream society. And those questions may have been different 100 years ago, but at the moment they're all the same questions, just being asked in different languages and in different ways. I know you're jumping in there, I know you want to answer this, because I don't know how properly to term that. It's responsibility is the key word.
I completely hear it, John. And the reason I'm keen to respond is I feel like the thing that you really articulated right at the beginning of that was so clear for me, and I feel so important that I don't want to lose that beginning part of the question, because I want to respond to it, because hopefully it will be of interest to you and also to the people listening. And I think it's a large part of the new way we need to do business, certainly in spiritual circles. That responsibility is huge, and my way of dealing with it is through respect for the other. My feeling is I never want to take away the other person's authority. What I want to do is keep returning their own authority to them so that, you know, I never want to belittle someone's question. I never want to tell somebody something. All I will want to do is say, well, I found this. Have a look for yourself. And I don't take anything I take on trust. You know, just but you know, put your bullshit detector on, see what you think of me. If I pass the test, let's hang out as friends and see where we what we can find together. I've had the good fortune to spend my life looking at this, and I might be able to help me. And I'm sure you've spent your life looking at other things, and if I needed some of that, then I could come to you. So yeah. It's that we're going to exchange on that basis, and that my job is not to be an authority for you. My job is to see is to help you see that in this area, you can only be your own authority, because only you can find this gnosis, this knowing, for yourself. And my job is just to point and say, look there, try this. Come here and experience this with me. What do you think?
Mm. Good answer.
Oh, I like that.
Like an anchor point. Because, yeah. I mean, this the awakening is such a, what's the word, a freedom that some people, and I'm sure you've seen this, that some people, they kind of lose themselves in this vast sea, this vast ocean of freedom that, yes. that comes with an awakening. That the, and I'm going to return to a very earlier question when we talked about gurus, and I mean, and when I mean that, I mean the negative type of gurus. They act as these kind of islands in this vast ocean, and these people who are on their journey sometimes wash ashore. And these gurus, instead of allowing them to come on shore, learn what they've got to learn, and then put them into a jetty and say, there's your life raft, there's all fully supplied, off you go, back on your journey again, back into the ocean. They kind of keep them on that island. And they keep on feeding them. The same material, just regurgitated in a different format. So it feeds that awakening. It feeds that desire for the answer to the truth that they're searching. Yet at the same time, it's not actually answering anything. It's literally just feeding the ego. So great answer, Tim. Great answer. Excellent answer.
Sorry, I respect that. Yeah, well, I just wanted to take that great segue into, because you mentioned it just a couple of minutes ago. I mentioned your book, The Jesus Mysteries, which was my introduction to what you to your work. And in that book, you are really spelling out the. Well, you went into Gnosticism, and you talk about gnosis, about knowing, and for those who. Wonder what that term means. I'll let Timothy define it. But for me, I have, at least in a religious sense, and maybe even in a spiritual sense, become almost agnostic, is that I don't know anything anymore. I used to know everything. You should ask me 20 years ago. So when you wrote this book, the purpose behind that, that book and that series of books that you've written on, what was the purpose behind that? It wasn't to deter anyone from what they believe. So what was that?
Well, the books weren't programmatic. They came about organically. I mean, gnosis, just to take that, for me, the route to, because of the paradox of life, the route to gnosis is through agnosticism. You know, but once you unpick yourself and realize you know nothing, there's the chance that you can discover the one thing you do know, which is actually before words. And the, it's another name, it's the ancient name, in India it's the Gnana, it's the same word. It's the for what we've been calling in this conversation being awake, or I call it the mystery experience sometimes. It has numbers of names, and sometimes it's called enlightenment, which is, can get a bit inflated. But it's the idea that there's something you can know directly, and when you do, it impresses itself upon you so powerfully, subjectively, that it is a profound transformation of consciousness. And for me, that's the center of all the religious traditions and spiritual traditions I've studied, have been individuals that have usually inspired these traditions, who've been having this experience and sharing it with others. I came to Christianity, I mean, I grew up in Christianity, but I came to write on Christianity through my dear friend, Peter Gandhi, who lives now next door to me, and I've known since he was 10 years old.
Oh, wow.
So we are, you know, he's my philosophical sparring partner, and we've been on a hell of a journey together. And at a certain point, we were brought together on that journey, and we started looking at the ancient mystery religions. What were they? I was interested. He was, by then, had become a a classicist. And we were studying those, and also what was Gnosticism, as separate things. And then from that, quite organically, we suddenly began to see that we were coming to a radical possibility that Christianity was a form of paganism, and that the Jesus story was the was a Jewish version of an ancient pagan initiation myth. And to be honest with you, that was not a program. We didn't set out to make that point. We just found it and at first thought that's impossible. And yet the further we went into it, the more this outrageous idea seemed to be endorsed by all of the evidence. And then our aim became to be, okay, so what we want to do is not is to go, let's what happens if we're rediscovering perhaps here what Christianity was originally about, which wasn't about believing in a supernatural being who came to earth, who was the Son of God and died and resurrected, but which is actually an initiatory myth to be, which was an allegory for one's own spiritual journey, and that therefore this whole thing was about discovering the Gnosis, which suddenly made it it wasn't about taking anything away, it was about giving something back, saying that there's more to Christianity, we thought, not less.
And of course, you will run headlong into the brick wall of church leaders who will be, find that to be heretical in some circles and downright yes. satanic in other circles.
Yes, and it's hard. I mean, there's no two ways about it. I'm sure you know in your own line of work. You know, I remember the first time. This is a long time ago now, but the first time that Peter and I were asked to debate. Well, Peter, I remember Peter going on to debate with the man who became the Archbishop of Canterbury.
Hmm.
And a feeling of, you know, these guys are going to be really tough to talk to. And, of course, actually they're not. Because, you know, where their starting place is an unquestioned, really, fundamentally unquestioned, belief in the veracity of an ancient book, which is clearly not history. And accepting on face value what is obviously a mythical, miraculous story.
What are you laughing about over there, John?
Because Tim's my man. Well said, Tim. Well said.
Thank you.
just carrying on with this theme, and retreading some old steps as well. Where do you think the turning point may be in a person's life when they're having this awakening, that they become? And I'm going to use this word, and I don't want anybody out there who's listening to the show. I don't want anybody to get upset. Forget about writing and complaining. Where do you think the turning point is where they feel that they become a prophet instead of a guru?
Well, that's interesting. What you're doing with using these words, John, which is brilliant, actually, is you're highlighting in the conversation just how loaded these terms are.
Mm.
You know, it's interesting, you know, you put a caveat, for instance, you know, when you describe me as a spiritual teacher, and you needed to do that, and you knew that I would want you to, but if I was a maths teacher, you wouldn't have needed to put that caveat around it. You know,
correct.
It's around, this area comes with so much, you know, if someone was a prophet of the future of economics, that would be fine, but mm-hmm. here it comes with, and why is that? And I think it's because in religion or in spirituality even, it's so easy to fall into a kind of absolutism. I really know. God is telling me. And therefore, rather than it being, yes, in one tone of voice, I would say, look, I'm a prophet. I'm standing up and going, guys, I think this is the future. Let's go this way together. That's the job of a prophet. But I'm not saying that because God has personally told me and only I know. And if you don't realize that, then that's because you're so ignorant. I'm saying that because that's what I found. Now, in any other area, that would be accepted. But here, we fall into these, you know, guru should be just, the word is from darkness to light. It should be just a teacher. It's just a name for a teacher. And yet it becomes absolute. And that is the greatest danger, whether it's in religion or indeed in science. The idea that a set of beliefs are the absolute truth. And the minute we do that, it's like eating the menu and not the meal. We've completely missed it, because the truth is always beyond that.
Oh, man. See, now that's...
I'm going to be sincere. Sorry, Scott, I've got to interrupt here. And you're going to like why I'm interrupting as well. That I'm going to be sincere here and truthful. When Scotty said to me the other week, he said, you know, we're going to be interviewing Timothy Freak. And I said, Freak? Freak? Sorry.
You've got a wonderful name for...
I'm sure you've had that a few times. And he said, no, look him up. He said, this guy, he's inspired me. I've read his books countless times. And he said, he is actually truthful about when he said he read your books and he was inspired by them and he's been following your work, because he has. Unfortunately, I haven't. Sorry to be honest there. And I looked at the website and I thought, we're going to be down one of these spiritual routes again. But what I'm hearing from you, Tim, actually, to be honest with you, is honesty and sincerity. And I've used those words only a couple of times when interviewing people on Intrepid Radio. And as Scotty can attest to that. But Scotty also said the other day, he sent me a quick message and said, John, we need to be in Glastonbury in July.
Yes.
And I went, yes, love to. And without even knowing that he was actually referring to yourself, Tim. And I love Glastonbury. I've been there so many times. I mean, through my own awakening, if we want to use those terminology. I mean, I remember the days when I was walking around with long hair, bangles hanging from everywhere, barefooted, walking through Glastonbury with my two children hanging off, them barefooted as well. And we were living in a VW van. Old 1962 V-dub, and it was parked up on an old lady's farmstead next to the Gypsy Caravan Park. It was behind us, if I remember rightly, and we were on a patch of land in front of that, around the corner, just outside the main street of Glastonbury. And we used to live there for a few months as we escaped the summers of Egypt, and we had some fantastic times there. So it's a pleasure listening to someone like yourself, Tim, and listening to the honesty and sincerity that comes in your voice, because as you quite rightly said, there are caveats that I have put deliberately in loaded questions here, using loaded words as well, trying to catch you out, and I will be honest by that, because we do, unfortunately, when we do go through this journey, this awakening, and you said it very early on in the interview that not a lot of people talk about it. We keep it to ourselves, and sometimes that's part of the bigger problem, that we do keep it to ourselves. We don't talk about it. We don't disseminate it. We don't debate it, and we don't discuss it, especially within certain social circles. And so it becomes a bit of a stigma. But attached to that stigma and attached to this words, awakening, spirituality, new age, are these loaded words, you know, the prophets, gurus, and so forth. And with them, there is a certain amount of negativity attached, because, you know, it's all about the buck. It's all about the money, the pound. It's always about the video, the DVD, the pamphlet, the retreat, this, that, and the other. Come and buy my pendant and meditate with me in the woods for 2 hours, and I'll only charge you £500 for that privilege. You know, it's that kind of mentality that we've been seeing for years that has had a kind of negative connotations and an effect for those who have been through the mill, so to speak, who have enjoyed the journey of the awakening and still are participating in that journey, but are afraid, if that's a good word to use, to step back into it, because they realize that there's so many of these charlatans out there.
Well, John,
to choose.
John, here's what I'm going to do. Timothy, hold on to that thought for a second, because we are right up against the break. We're actually over break. So hold on. We're going to come back, and we're going to let John either finish his talking about his hippie past and let Tim respond to that. So, folks, hang on. You're listening to me, Scotty Roberts, and Dr. John Ward with our guest, Timothy Freak. We'll be right back after this message from our sponsors. Hang on.
Imagine a place, beautiful, green, sloping mountains, and a rich, mysterious window into our ancient past. It's a culture the likes of which you won't find any place else. And while the place I'm describing is in Vermont, it's also the home of Inner Traditions, publishers of fine books on mind, body, and spirit for more than 3 decades. Inner Traditions are internationally recognized publishers of everything from occult to esoteric and spiritual books, as well as the leading authorities on alternative health, holistic healing, sacred sexuality, altered states of of consciousness, and so much more. And frankly, it's not the kind of information you'll find just anywhere. Exploring the inner secrets of humanity requires thinking outside the box. And when it comes to inner traditions, the name says it all. All you have to do to learn more is visit innertraditions.com and you can receive a free catalog that will tell you all about their latest books and newest authors. That's Inner Traditions and Baron Company, publishers of fine esoteric books for more than three decades. Find them online at innertraditions.com.
Carl Sagan once wrote that the questioning mind needs to be instilled with both skepticism and wonder, for the universe is a pretty big place, filled with undelved mysteries, sciences, and life that we've barely begun to comprehend. Every month, Intrepid Magazine brings you both the wondrous and the skeptical. Intrepid Magazine focuses on science, metaphysics, UFOs, politics, conspiracies, and unexplained phenomena, all offered up by Intrepid's cadre of writers and contributors, comprised of a host of seasoned authors, pundits, and recognized names in their fields. The universe is indeed a big place, and where other magazines leave off, Intrepid Mag is just beginning. Subscribe to Intrepid Magazine today at www.intrepidmag.com. That's www.intrepidmag.com.
For the thousands of wounded warriors returning from battle, Wounded Warrior Project has developed the Warriors to Work program, a career counseling service that helps wounded warriors translate their military experience to a civilian job. These extraordinary men and women bring more than just teamwork and inspiration to the workplace. They bring proven world-class job skills. And to ensure proper placement, Wounded Warrior Project works with employers to find just the right job fit. Talented, skilled, and eager to get back to work, you have the opportunity to hire a seasoned veteran. Contact Wounded Warrior Project at findwwp.org. Welcome home, the brave.
Are you ready for some rollicking adventure? In Scotty Roberts' book, The Rollicking Adventures of Tam O'Hare, join Irish Rabbit, Tam O'Hare, and his young squirrel squire, Horatio McNutt, as they journey through Scotland of the mid-1500s seeking a small child who's been stolen by the fairy folk. Crafty raccoon pirates, conniving noble wolves, conflicted royal foxes, and self-serving religious badgers all stand in the way as their quest brings them headlong into high seas action and supernatural intrigue. The Rollicking Adventures of Tam O'Hare is in bookstores everywhere and at barnesandnoble.com. This hardcover, lushly illustrated chapter book is the first book in the Tam O'Hare series, so swash your buckle and prepare yourself for a historically rollicking, swaggeringly supernatural adventure. Visit TamO'Hare.com to learn more. You'll never trust a raccoon with a sword again.
Without any ado, we're going to launch right back into what John was talking about. Go ahead, John, and Timothy, if you've already got a response planned for that, let's go.
I've forgotten where I was. Timothy, I hope you've got a response.
Well, my response is very short, really, John. My response is thank you, because I think it's lovely to hear your sincerity coming back. And I think, you know, that's great. I mean, I would like, you know, what I'm loving about the conversation with you both is that I feel probably like yourselves. I want to be able to move fluidly between being able to laugh, at myself and each other, and also to become very serious, and also to be able to come into tender places where we can talk about words which, like love or authenticity or sincerity, and where we can be real with each other in all those different ways. And, you know, why it was delightful to hear you talk about your hippie past is because it feels like, yes, I can relate to that, of course. I'm in Glastonbury, you know, it's like I can remember that and all of that. And it's that kind of, that's what I want to see. I want to see us really engaging with the human drama as it is, from the deepest place within us and with as much love as we can find. And the more of us that can see that and bring that to this adventure, and that means open-mindedness, and another word for that is being able to doubt, but it also means being able to be open to see new ways of seeing, to share with each other in a way that we can find. What's the best story? It's all a story. You know, the thing itself will always remain a mystery, but we need a story about it. So what's the best story we can find? What have you got? What have I got? And that we can keep opening up things and finding new possibilities, and that through that we become deeper and richer and improve the lives that we're living and the lives of the people around us. And so, in a way, my journey has been through immense complexity, writing these books on history and philosophy, back to something which is incredibly simple, really. And the gnosis that we talked about, why I love it so much, it couldn't be simpler. At the end of our book on Gnosticism, Jesus and the Lost Goddess, Peter Gandhi and I thought, well, let's try and say, how would we encapsulate this gnosis? And ended up saying something very banal, which was, everything's okay. and thought, and you know what? That's the one thing I really need to know, that despite everything, despite all the suffering, a whole damn journey, despite all of the horror, there's a knowing that it's okay. I don't know how it's okay, but it is. And that expresses itself as a love of life.
You just picked up on two words there, which I wanted to, again, I wanted to put another question to you, without the caveats this time. But one of the things that, and I'm sure you've noticed this over the many, many years that you've been in this position, privileged position at that, and that is that one of the main components of being or going through this awakening, this journey, is that there's always this in-depth fear of an impending doom.
Yeah.
I'm sure you've come across it so many times, like we all have. But it's kind of heightened when one becomes oneness. And I think this inbuilt mechanism kicks in, and we're able to perceive fear on a whole different level. And I believe
John, when you say that, do you mean, just explain what you mean by that. Do you mean like apocalypse and that sort of fear?
Well, that's where I want to get to, but then I wanted to draw away from that, because that's part, I believe, of the journey. It's that impending doom and gloom, the apocalyptic end. It's coming.
Yeah.
And then we kind of, as we continue along the journey, and this again, I'm picking up on bits that we've already discussed, like the guru on the island in the ocean of freedom. You may land on one island where you've got this guru who says, yes, the end is coming, you must come to me, buy my videos, buy my books, and I will save you, build a bunker and we will all live happily ever after, just pay me $10,000 per year and we'll be fine. But for some, they manage to escape that island and they continue along the journey, but they are more than aware that there just isn't something, just not right with the world. There's something out of place here.
It's part of the Gnostic. I mean, the Gnostics certainly had that. It's one of the things I like about them. My sense is that we haven't really had time to go into it in depth, but this paralogical philosophy that I've been developing, based on this understanding that fundamentally everything at its depth is paradoxical, expresses itself in that we feel that if you look deeply, you come to see everything's on that knife edge. That life is at once the most beautiful thing and the most terrible thing. That each one of us is here alive right now, but knows that one of us could die while we're having this conversation. And the older you get, the more you see that happen.
Are you okay?
I'm just fine. No, that was just my mute button.
Okay. just making sure.
True, isn't it? You know, that you see this, the more sensitive you become, the more open you become, the more you see the suffering that's actually all around us, and that can be overwhelming. So one of the reasons I think often is that people don't open themselves to the depths of love within them, is because it involves suffering, because it's an opening to seeing how much suffering there is in the world, and that is difficult. So often we shy away from it for that reason. Mm. So all of those fears, and they all become exaggerated, and there's immense... You know, once you step out of your conventional mindset, I think this is really probably the thing you're talking about more than anything else, John, is that, you know, when you said the ocean of freedom, once somebody initially awakes, they awake out of their conditioning, and their conditioning is wherever they happen to have been born. And then suddenly that's no longer necessarily true, and they're open to new possibilities. Yet they haven't got the discernment yet necessarily, probably, almost certainly, at that point, to be able to find the next step to go. So it will be anything, whatever happens to come along. And therefore, they're very open to all sorts of, you know, fear, huge hubris. Oh, you are now a member of this group. There's only three of us, but we are the chosen ones. And you can feel good about that. And whilst you're not the chosen one, you are close to me, which makes you pretty chosen. And all of that stuff, and, you know, and I've been there myself in different ways through when I was young, and, you know, that's all, you know, and the hope is you just keep going.
I see the life of Brian now.
Yes.
No, follow his gourd.
Titans did it.
Tim, what is the key to, and this is, I suppose, personal responsibility in this, or personal appropriation, what's the key to authenticity with this? Because I know where John was talking about the fears. I know there are the conditioned fears that we also have. It's like, this is all great, and then there's a moment where you stop, and if anybody's anything like me, there's the tendrils of the old religious conditioning. Says, oh, this is all anti-God, or this is all this, whatever label you want to put on it, and it draws you back from it sometimes because you recede into that fear. What is the key that you could give people in tonight's broadcast? I would tell them, here is the step to authenticity with this, to overcoming that.
Well, I mean, the thing which comes to mind, you know, the authenticity, I think it's being able to see there'll always be two sides to everything. Don't expect it to be just one side. Everything is ambiguous. So to be authentic is to see the ambiguity of oneself and of life and of every situation. And then the telltale sign for me, what I look for, is love. If I see genuine love, if I see humble love, then I feel safe. And if I don't see that, then I'm very, very, very careful.
Oh, man, that's hitting it on the head. You know, when I said to John, we're going to do this interview with you, I knew we were going to talk about some of this, but I really wanted to focus on some of the Gnostic stuff in the books. And it's really, this conversation has gone away from that, and that's, I'm fine with that. I'm fine with where we've gone and what we've been talking about. And this has just been, to me, fascinating, and it's uplifting, and it's encouraging on different levels. Because I'll be very honest and say, I still approach all of this stuff wanting to know answers. I do what I do, and I do the things I do with John, even on a historical or archaeological basis. I do those things because I want to know something. And is this as simple, all of this, as simple as just... And I hate this phrase. This is another one of those catchphrases that comes with all this, is letting go. Oh, Scotty, just let go. And it's like, how do you let go of what you carry with you? Of what's
it's the,
part
it's
of
the
you.
Paradox again, Scotty, for me. It's like, because I'm the same as you. I want... but I think that curiosity towards knowing in that sense about the world and about history and about each other, that's a wonderful quality we've got as human beings. But this gnosis is in the opposite direction. This gnosis is something before words, and that is something we find by letting go. And that's where the deep sense of safety, of love, and of oneness arises. And that's not something we know as information. That's something much, much closer. And then fine, that's what we've got a mind for, is to inquire about the rest. How lovely.
I like what you just said there. It's not information. It's not the attaining of more information. It's a different kind of an appropriation. It's from within.
Yeah.
Well, John, unless you have something else, I think this is pretty darn close to where we've got a wrap.
I could go on all night.
But, I could too, Peter. Let's pour a cup. I'm sorry, Peter. Peter, I said I meant Timothy. I was looking at Peter Gandy's name right up in front of me.
I'm surprised. Peter and I have merged at some level. I feel that sometimes even my wife calls me Peter. So, it's a bizarre little thing that's gone on. We've become friends for so long.
Well, hopefully that's not too disconcerting when that happens. well, Tim, this has been enlightening, and like I say, I would be just as satisfied here in the library to throw another log on the fire and pour a couple of pints and keep going, but we've got our time constraints with this show. I want to thank you for being here, and before we let you go, let people know where they can find out more about you. I've mentioned themysteryexperience.com. Tell people where they can find out more about this, what you do, things you have coming up that people might be able to attend, so on.
Well, themysteryexperience.com is a great place to start. Or just Google Tim Freak, F-R-E-K-E. It's such a weird name. You'll find me. But you don't have to spell it right, F-R-E-K-E. On the website, there's a lovely little five-minute video, which I hope conveys something of the feeling of this gnosis, of this mystery experience. So that's a great place to come in. There's also lots of talks and conversations and stuff which is of interest. And then there's events, and I'm doing online events, just started. So every month we're going to do an online gathering, and I'll do questions, and we'll talk about awakening and about this stuff in the manner that we have together here. And also I run these mystery experience retreats. As you said, I've got one in Glastonbury. I think it's pretty much full now, but that's in the end of this month. Then there's another on the specifically on the Gnostics. Now, it's the same thing. I'm still interested in going to the Gnosis, and I hope to give people the actual experience. It's not an academic thing. It's an experiential thing. But I'll be using the philosophy of Gnosticism to explore it, or my version of that. And that's in September. And then I will be coming to the States. I'm just in the process, today, actually, of discussing dates. Well, they'll be announced soon, I hope, for next year. It might be at the end of this year, but it's more likely to be in the spring of 2015. So if anyone's interested in actually experiencing this stuff and getting together with me, the best thing to do is get to the website. There's a place where you can join a newsletter. If you join the newsletter, you'll get little bits coming through of inspiration every now and again. And you can also hear when I come to the States or wherever you are in the world.
You know, we may have to talk to you about the Paradigm Symposium 2015 next year in October. That's it. We'll talk about that a little later. Folks, this has been Timothy Freak, and you've heard what he's all about. This has been a wonderful show for me. I just don't want it to end. But, Timothy, thanks again for being with us.
It's been a real delight.
Thank you very much, Tim. Thank you very much. And I do apologize that you've had to speak to Scotty for so long.
And we'll end it on that note. Timothy, this has been great. What a wonderful experience just talking to you. It's been good.
Well, thank you. I've really enjoyed meeting you both. It really has been a delight.
Well, hopefully we'll have the opportunity. I know I said to John just a couple of days ago, I said, we need to go to Glastonbury at the end of July. And he said, why? And I told him why. So we were starting to look into that, whether it's even feasible for us right now. We've got so much on our plate. It's unbelievable.
Well, maybe come in September.
September, maybe. I know John's wife has a baby coming in September. My wife at age, I'm age 53. My wife is a bit younger than I am. We've got a baby coming in November.
Oh, my goodness.
We've got our big symposium at the beginning of, this is our third year doing the Paradigm Symposium here, beginning of October. Then we take a tour group to Egypt for the Exodus Reality Adventures the second 2 weeks of October. And we have a pending television show, which is very much on the forefront of everything right now. And so our lives may become very, very busy over the next few months.
Don't forget my 2 months at Silsila in the middle of the desert.
Oh, yeah, their season at their archaeological site at Gebel El Silsila down in the Nile. So.
Well, you're probably going to be very much tied up with child-rearing, I suspect. But the other event which we do every year, which is fantastic, really, is we do something at New Year. We have one at a retreat over New Year.
Oh.
That's a very special time to come here as well. We have this beautiful old manor house overlooking the Abbey ruins right in the middle of Glastonbury. And have a New Year celebration for
is that days. Your home? You own that? That's
no,
your home?
No, oh, no, it's, okay. It's actually owned by the Church of England.
Oh.
We it becomes ours for that period. And we have a retreat and a party. We do the same experiential stuff, but it has a very special feel because it's a New Year.
Well, John, we should do that.
This is where Tim really gets into the truth of it all, and he turns around and says that he's carrying out pagan rituals. And that's where he starts to really tweak my interest.
I'll tell you, I've got
Alistair Crowley looking back at me at the moment.
I've been to Glastonbury twice, and the last time was about 8 years ago, and I definitely want to go back. For me, when I originally went there, it was linked to the Arthurian legends, and that's why I wanted to go there. So a very interesting place, and we definitely have to work out something to getting to one of your events. September's probably out, at least for John, unless he tells Maria, hey, if your water breaks, just call me, I'll be in Glastonbury.
Don't forget, I'm going to be at Keele University in the 5th and 6th of September for the Dowsers.
Man, well, anyway.
Well, when our paths cross, I look forward to it.
Timothy, thank you very much. What a wonderful conversation.
That was a great interview. Great interview.
It certainly was. And, you know, the chat room over there, and those of you who are still over there listening in the chat room, was just buzzing with all this stuff all night. And there is so much question about... And one of the questions that came up and I addressed a couple of times in the chat room when I could was that issue of letting go of the things that are so ingrained in us is a very difficult thing, especially when you feel you've been shown something different over here that either illuminates that or, as Timothy would say, wakes you up. How do you let go of the old stuff in order to...
I don't think you do you?
Is it a letting go, or is it an assimilating? Is it a mixing? Is it a... And, you know, the question even came up in the chat room about the things that we have believed at one point that may prevent us from thinking beyond a certain stage. That there's a lot of people, and I can't remember who said it, but there's a lot of people out there that have problems with old things that were taught to us that we seem to know better now, but there's not a way to express the moving on from that into something different or something better.
I think Tim actually articulated that the best way, and that is to acknowledge them, and that you keep, as we do, Scotty, in our job, and that is keep both feet in both camps. You acknowledge them, and at any given point, you can go backwards or forwards between your what I call the conditioning. And so it's about acknowledgement. It's about the dual aspect. It's about, because as you know, and many of our listeners will know, and as Timothy said himself, you know, you can't wander through this world, not today's modern world, being in a permanent trance, a state of oneness, a state of loving and embracing and so forth, because it just doesn't work. You just can't do it. You wouldn't accomplish anything. And how can you even begin then to be part of a modern society in that way? It's impossible. So you have to have 2 feet, one in one camp and one in the other camp. And that allows you then to transcend between both aspects, and the acknowledgement of the old and the acknowledgement of the new. And then you can basically, like we do, you can wear one hat for one scenario and wear another hat for another scenario. I think there's a harmony to be had. I think that's the clever word to use here. Harmony.
Yeah. Yeah. And for me, this is maybe part of some of that sensationalizing we were talking about at the very beginning. We become so desensitized to anything
like this? And we talked about this in the interview. How does he differentiate what he says and what he's teaching from the millions of gurus out there who are doing it for the next buck and buy my book and all of this stuff? This is the stuff that makes you think on a much different level and on a much deeper level. And what's interesting to me is that the old forms of religion and the old things that are ingrained are things that we believe because we were told to believe them or we were taught to believe them without proofs of... And I know I'm walking on dangerous ground with some people here, but without the proofs of there being any veracity to that, yet this is the stuff that Timothy's talking about that we can do on a daily basis, which enriches that. And so... I'm just trying to encapsulate.
There is a danger there, brother. There is a danger there because, I mean, and this goes back to what I was saying earlier and as we've discussed many times, and that's responsibility. Sometimes you've got to step up to the fold and acknowledge the fact that you have a responsibility to other people that I want to use the word follow, but it's too hard a word, but to those, your audience, you have the responsibility towards them. And I think it's about time that some people out there should wake up to the fact that they do have a responsibility and people do listen to what they have to say and they do act upon it. And there's a due process there. Don't you see? Do you agree?
I do. You know, and something, Thomas Fusco is over in our chat room and he mentioned here.
Good evening,
that,
Thomas.
Yes, good evening, Thomas. He says you can't go through the world straddling the middle line. And he doesn't believe what he believes because he was taught it. And let me address that for a second here because that was just a simple way I was trying to encapsulate a thought there. I'm not saying that I believe what I believe because I was taught that thing. I question what I believe because of what I was taught many times. But I would say that the vast majority of people that are out there believe what they believe. They appropriate a belief because this is what their church leaders or their religious leaders have taught them to believe. That's more the point I'm making is that many of us believe what we believe because that's the way it was presented to us. This is what we were told was the truth. And this is what we were told would be the penalties for not believing that truth. And that's where I have had difficulty, even after 20 years of asking questions, of separating completely from that. Not that I have to, and I'm using language that's going to be questioned just because it's a conversation about this. This is something that takes hours to articulate sometimes. The easiest way to say this in a sentence would just simply be, it's difficult even though I don't believe all I was taught in the religion I was in. It's always difficult to find myself thinking in new arenas or expanded arenas because the tendrils of the old come up and grab you.
But isn't that straddling the middle line?
No, it's not an active... I'm not actively straddling the middle line with that. Actively straddling the middle line, I think, would look like saying, I accept both, and I'm going to appropriate and mix both of them together. That's a straddling of the middle line.
No, I don't think that is. I don't think that
it's straddling the middle line is an active action.
I think that's acknowledgement.
What's acknowledgement?
It's acknowledgement of both. You acknowledge your conditioning, but at the same time, you acknowledge that which you are learning, because we are all on a learning path. We never stop learning, and we never stop forming conclusions. And we also, at the same time, while that learning process is continuing along that pathway, there are some points where we will look back and think, well, no, hang on a minute. That doesn't make sense with what I learned back then. So then you take a different pathway, but you never forget what you've learned, because if you forgot what you learned, you wouldn't know where you've been. It's like history. We cannot begin to fathom where we are heading if we do not know where we have been.
Well, let me kind of encapsulate a thought here and maybe leave it on this. I'll leave my part of this alone after this. And maybe this sounds a bit more cynical to some people. I don't think this was originally delivered as cynical. And I've quoted him many times, was Richard Feynman. astral physicist, contemporary of Einstein and Oppenheimer and so on. And he said, the basic thing for me is to question and to doubt. And he says, and when I question and I doubt, I find it harder to believe. Mm. And I think, though, that at the core of my nature is to question and to doubt. And it's not that I'm seeking something to believe, it's seeking something to know. And I don't want to just believe something. I want to know something. And I think that's what Timothy brought up tonight.
Yeah, I will agree with everyone. I will agree.
And on that, we're out, folks. John and I are back next week. Thanks for joining us tonight. This has been a great experience tonight. So thanks for tuning in here at Intrepid Radio on the KGRA digital broadcasting station.
Thank you, everybody.